There were fresh horses waiting in the upper village of Varennes. The young officer in charge had given the king up for the night and gone to bed. While for half an hour, in the lower village, the poor king, disguised as a valet, disputed with his postilions, who had expected reliefs in the lower village and refused to go further. Finally, they consented to go on. They consented too late. The little party found the postmaster from Saint-Menehould, who had ridden past while the postilions wrangled, and a number of worthy republicans of Varennes, whom he had gathered together, awaiting them at the bridge between the two parts of the town. The bridge was barricaded. Muskets were thrust into the carriage. "Your passports?" The king surrendered without a struggle. The little party was taken into the house of some village functionary. "Well," said the king, "here you have me." Also he remarked that he was hungry. At dinner he commended the wine, quite excellent wine. What the queen said is not recorded. There were royalist troops at hand, but they attempted no rescue. The tocsin began to ring, and the village illuminated itself to guard against surprise. A very crestfallen coachload of royalty returned to Paris and was received by vast crowds in silence. The word had gone forth that whoever insulted the king should be thrashed, and whoever applauded him should be killed. It was only after this foolish exploit that the idea of a republic took hold of the French mind. Before this flight to Varennes, there was no doubt much abstract republican sentiment, but there was scarcely any expressed disposition to abolish monarchy in France. Even in July, a month after the flight, a great meeting in the Champ de Mars, supporting a petition for the dethronement of the king, was dispersed by the authorities, and many people were killed. But such displays of firmness couldn't prevent the lesson of that flight soaking into men's minds. Just as in England, in the days of Charles I, so now in France, men realized that the king could not be trusted. He was dangerous. The Jacobins grew rapidly in strength. Their leaders, Robespierre, Danton, Marat, who had hitherto been figured as impossible extremists, began to dominate French affairs. These Jacobins were the equivalents of the American radicals, men with untrammeled advanced ideas. Their strength lay in the fact that they were unencumbered and downright. They were poor men with nothing to lose. The party of moderation, of compromise with the relics of the old order, was led by such men of established position as General Lafayette, the general who had represented France in America, and Mirabeau, an aristocrat who was ready to model himself on the rich and influential aristocrats of England. But Robespierre was a needy but clever young lawyer from Arras, whose most precious possession was his faith in Rousseau. Danton was a scarcely more wealthy barrister in Paris, a big, gesticulating, rhetorical figure. Marat was an older man, a Swiss, of very great scientific distinction, but equally unembarrassed by possession. On Marat's scientific standing, it's necessary to lay stress, because there's a sort of fashion among English writers to misrepresent the leaders of great revolutionary movements as ignorant men. This gives a false view of the mental processes of revolution, and it's the task of the historian to correct it. Marat, we find, was conversant with English, Spanish, German, and Italian. He had spent several years in England, he was made an honorary M.D. of St. Andrews, and had published some valuable contributions to medical science in English. Both Benjamin Franklin and Goethe were greatly interested in his work in physics. This is the man who is called by Carlyle Rabid Dog, atrocious, squalid, and dog-leech, this last by way of tribute to his science. The Revolution called Marat to politics, and his earliest contributions to the great discussion were fine and sane. there was a prevalent delusion in France that England was a land of liberty. His tableau des vices de la Constitution d'Angleterre showed the realities of the English position. His last years were maddened by an almost intolerable skin disease, which he caught while hiding in the sewers of Paris to escape the consequences of his denunciation of the king as a traitor after the flight to Varennes. Only by sitting in a hot bath could he collect his mind to write. He had been treated hardly and suffered, and he became hard. Nevertheless, he stands out in history as a man of rare, unblemished honesty. His poverty seems particularly to have provoked the scorn of Carlyle. What a road he has travelled, and he sits now, about 7:30 of the clock, stewing in slipper bath, sore afflicted, ill of revolution fever. Excessively sick and worn, poor man, with precisely 11½ of ready money in paper, with slipper bath, strong 3-footed stool for writing on the while, and a squalid washerwoman for his sole household. That is his civic establishment in Medical School Street. Thither, and not elsewhere, has his road led him. Hark, a rap again, a musical woman's voice, refusing to be rejected. It is the citoyenne who would do France a service. Marat, recognizing from within, cries, "Admit her!" Charlotte Corday is admitted. The young heroine, for Republican leaders, are fair game, and their assassins are necessarily heroines and their voices musical, offered to give him some necessary information about the counter-revolution at Caen, and as he was occupied in making a note of her facts, she stabbed him with a large sheath knife in 1792. Such was the quality of most of the leaders of the Jacobin party. They were men of no property, untethered men. They were more dissociated and more elemental, therefore, than any other party, and they were ready to push the ideas of freedom and equality to a logical extremity. Their standards of patriotic virtue were high and harsh. There was something inhuman, even in their humanitarian zeal. They saw, without humour, the disposition of the moderates to ease things down, to keep the common folk just a little needy and respectful, and royalty and men of substance just a little respected. They were blinded by the formulae of Rousseauism to the historical truth that man is by nature oppressor and oppressed, and that it's only slowly, by law, education, and the spirit of love in the world, that men can be made happy and free. And while in America the formulae of 18th-century democracy were on the whole stimulating and helpful because it was already a land of open-air practical equality so far as white men were concerned, in France these formulae made a very heady and dangerous mixture for the town populations because considerable parts of the towns of France were slums, full of dispossessed, demoralized, degraded, and bitter-spirited people. The Parisian crowd was in a particularly desperate and dangerous state, because the industries of Paris had been largely luxury industries, and much of her employment parasitic on the weaknesses and vices of fashionable life. Now the fashionable world had gone over the frontier, travellers were restricted, business disordered, and the city full of unemployed and angry people. But the royalists, instead of realizing the significance of these Jacobins, with their dangerous integrity and their dangerous grip upon the imagination of the mob, had the conceit to think they could make tools of them. The time for the replacement of the National Assembly under the new-made constitution by the Legislative Assembly was drawing near, and when the Jacobins, with the idea of breaking up the moderates, proposed to make the members of the National Assembly ineligible for the Legislative Assembly, the royalists supported them with great glee and carried the proposal. They perceived that the Legislative Assembly, so clipped of all experience, must certainly be a politically incompetent body. They would extract good from the excess of evil, and presently France would fall back helpless into the hands of her legitimate masters. So they thought, And the royalists did more than this. They backed the election of a Jacobin as mayor of Paris. It was about as clever as if a man brought home a hungry tiger to convince his wife of her need of him.